gracebiblechurch.org.
Org.
Org, like a pirate, okay? Gracebiblechurch.org. Any other dots will get you a confusing situation, but those will get you to Grace Bible Church's backlog of lessons out there. All righty. Okay, we've been working our way through the book of Daniel. Last week we saw, we saw actually the transition. Well, remember in chapter 2 we saw that four-segmented statue? Each of those four segments representing a Gentile world empire. This chart does the same thing. You just see it this way and instead of that way. Well, Daniel has managed to live all the way through this first era here, the Babylonian Empire, into the Medo-Persian Empire. So he's now kind of in the early days of that. So this one lasted how long? Remember how long the Babylonian Empire lasted? 70 years. Jeremiah 25, 70 years. Daniel lived through that. He started out maybe as a teenager, got through that 70 years, so he's probably like 85, 87, something like that maybe. In the second one of those, the Medo-Persian Empire. So we're already seeing in this short period in this book the fulfillment of that sweeping prophecy in chapter 2 involving that statue. So we're into in chapter 5 we saw the transition from the Babylonian Empire into the Medo-Persian Empire with the handwriting on the wall incident. Remember that? Meeny, meeny, tekel, you farson. God has given you a job review, Belshazzar, and you have failed on all fronts. You're no good at anything, and he's going to take the empire away from you, the Babylonian Empire away, and give it to the Medo-Persians. And he did, and they came in and took over the place. And a guy named Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. So he's our new top dog guy now, following Nebuchadnezzar. His course has been ran, and other people are now in charge. The second one of those Gentile world empires has come about. Okay? Now, they don't know it's as long as we know it is. At the time, if they read Daniel's book, they would see four world empires, and they would be puzzled about this fourth one. They wouldn't know quite how to figure out what in the heck those 10 toes mixed with iron and clay on the feet of that thing were all about. They wouldn't know what that's about. They wouldn't even know what that part of it is about or anything else, other than they could probably tell from his prophecy, especially if they read Jeremiah's also, that these Gentile world empires were going to run their course. So, chapter 5 brings about the second one of those, the Medo-Persian Empire. So, we're now into the second one up there of those four in Daniel chapter 6. And our head guy now is a guy named Darius. Or Darius, I don't know how this is pronounced. I probably pronounce it different ways myself, but it's the same guy. So it seemed good to him, chapter 6, verse 1. It seemed good to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king may not suffer loss. So the new organizer in chief here of the Medo-Persian Empire, he's taken over this empire, and he combines the two of them, and he says, you know, I think I'm going to organize this thing in the old classical pyramidal type shape, and I'm going to put 120 guys, 120 governors, like, scattered around throughout the country, each of which will report to one of three different honchos over them, 40 each reporting to this guy, and their job is to look out for his interest, make sure he doesn't suffer any loss, that things are well. And Daniel is one of these three. So Daniel is a high muckety-muck in this new empire, as he was in the old one. It's worth noting probably that the new guy recognizes in Daniel, maybe in a couple other guys, I don't know.
So back then they didn't care about having a leader in their in his 80s.
Having a leader where?
In his 80s.
In the what?
In his 80s.
Oh, in his 80s. That's right. No, in fact, back then they had the good sense to recognize that the guys were just hitting their prime in their 80s. That's right. No problem at all to be in your 80s back in these days. Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, he would not be a good example, would he?
Do you think that the reason that they had to go outside their regular box and go to Daniel is because by the time Belshazzar was in charge, the quality of the advisors had gone down so and had gotten so concentrated into their own little mindset that they were not benefiting from the influx of knowledge from the captured peoples that they then brought. Daniel was not of their people.
Yeah.
But he could read that.
They must have had pretty good insight into who the good leaders were when they took over the place. We don't know who the other two guys were, if they were Jews or what. But he apparently saw quite quickly in Daniel the qualities that he wanted in leadership. Probably didn't take too many conversations with leftovers to figure out he was the guy he wanted in charge there. So he's clearly a worthy, capable guy, and the new leader liked him as well as the old leader. Puts him in charge. And then Daniel, on top of that, he began to distinguish himself among those three and the satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. Yeah, that spirit's called godliness. That's what Daniel possessed. Even these pagan leaders recognized quality of character and godliness in his behavior, and the guy sees quite, Darius sees fairly early on, and I don't know exactly how quick, but fairly early on, that Daniel was even better than the other two, and he was going to appoint him over the entire kingdom. So Daniel is distinguishing himself in his mid to late 80s as a good leader, and Darius is going to put him in charge of the whole place, the whole Medo-Persian Empire under himself, of course. Clearly, God's hand is on Daniel. Obedience to God's principles and instruction on how to live is paying off for Daniel. God is blessing him, and he's rising to the top of this place pretty quick. Now, remember, Daniel is a Jew. He's either a Benjamite or a Judahite. That's the only two tribes that were left when Nebuchadnezzar took over the place. So he's one of those two. But he's a Jew. And there's probably a bunch of other Gentile peoples and leaders in the kingdom as well. So the commissioner and the satraps begin trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel. What do we call that general attitude being displayed here today? What's that called? Is that not anti-Semitism? Yeah, they're against Daniel. Daniel's doing good and they don't like it. All of the regulars there, I'm imagining they're all Gentiles, but I don't know for certain. But the other two commissioners and the 120 satraps, the governors or whatever they are, they don't like that Daniel is rising to the cream of the crop here. So they try to find something to accuse him of, some sort of sedition, some sort of anti-Darius the Mede thinking that they could, to try to, in essence, short his career directly to ground. But they couldn't find anything. No ground of accusation or evidence of corruption. inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Wow, he's a lot like our leaders today. No corruption could be found in him. Have you ever seen anything like what we got going on in this government today? Most corrupt thing I've ever seen in my life, and nobody can do a thing about it. Nobody cares. You can gripe and complain. You can go on TV and mouth off, and nothing ever happens. The same people are in the same jobs, selling the country down the drain, just like they were before. Nothing changes in this country.
I don't know if I agree with the anti-Semitism portion, because they don't like him because they're jealous of how good he is. That doesn't mean that it's a product of his religion. And even later on, when they say the only way we can get at him is through his religion, I still don't think that counts as anti-Semitism.
Well,
I think it's whatever cause they can turn to their purpose.
Yeah, well, you can call it whatever you want, but they're against Daniel.
Yes.
Daniel is the only Jew, apparently, at this level of government, and they're after him. No, and they're not. We don't have enough information about them to know exactly what the motivation may be here. But clearly, they don't like the fact that he's outperforming them. He's outshining them on the job, to be sure. So they can't find nothing. His behavior is so praiseworthy that they're striking out. And they kind of get a little party going there, and they say, well, hey, we ain't going to find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. They know that the only chance they have is to try to find something that Daniel is doing in obedience to his God and use that against him. Because they can't find anything else. His business acumen is good. He's reliable. He's trustworthy. He's honest. All of the things that you might come up with to try to use it against him, they got nothing. But they know he's so devoted to his God that they're going to look there. Yeah, Bob, do you have a question?
In the court of law, that would be anti-Semitism, because they're basing on what they're going after is the law of God, which are the Jews. So that would fit the definition.
Yeah, it looks like it's some form of it, maybe not as cruel.
But I think if you come down to the real situation, it is anti-Semitism.
Yeah. Yeah, and remember, this is a very pagan.
One phrase right there.
Yeah.
So it was the vehicle that they used to get at it.
Mm-hmm.
That what he had was unique.
And remember, this is a very pagan society.
Mm-hmm.
So he would stand out in this society of godless, heathen, idolatrous people. So they said, they came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. Says, King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, well, maybe not all, maybe most. I don't think Daniel is involved in this accusation, is he? All the commissioners, the prefects, the satraps, high officials, everybody has consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Whoa. Hey, anybody that appeals to his god other than you, O Medo-Persian honcho, if anybody does that, in the next 30 days, we're going to make him cat food. What do you think about that deal? So now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. So if you make an edict and sign it, even the fearless leader can't change it. So that's their plan. Get something in writing that they can hold against Daniel and he can't change it. So he fell for that. Anytime people want to glorify a man, be careful. That's a good place to get into trouble. They're trying to glorify old King Darius here, and it's going to lead to problems.
I wonder what authority they gave to the law of Medes and Persians that you can't change it. Where did that authority come from?
I don't know. They probably have something like a constitution, I guess, or some sort of a basis of law of government. Maybe it's in something like that. I don't know where that originated. I don't know why you would want to do that, quite frankly, because obviously if you make a mistake of any kind, you're stuck with your mistake. But apparently is there a law? Now, they don't know anything about this time period right here yet. They can't possibly figure that out from what they know. We know a lot about it. We know that it is a time period in which the Jewish people will be the most hated people on the planet. They will have no allies, including the United States. Anti-Semitism will be at a peak. Everybody will hate them. So the question becomes, in their minds, later on, how are we going to survive this thing? How are we going to survive 7 years of everybody on the planet hating us? How's that going to work out for us? Now, they don't know now, but when that time period comes, this chapter in this book is going to be a real source of comfort to them, because it's going to show them how God can protect and take care of His people, His obedient people, during the most difficult of times. They're not here yet. The Jews aren't reading Daniel chapter 6, probably looking for comfort and help in this world, but they will be. This chapter will become, I think, a real, often preached, often taught chapter in God's Word by the 144,000 sealed Jews during that tribulation period, because the Jewish people will be looking for some source of comfort. How are we going to survive with everybody against us? And the 144,000 are probably going to say, here, I'll show you how you can survive. Let me review Daniel chapter 6 for you again. So this chapter, I think, will be way, way more important and taught during the tribulation period than it would be during the period leading up to that, because of the need that it meets. So the setup is, anybody that obeys God and adores Him and worships Him is going to get to meet some kitty cats up close and personal. Going to get thrown in a lion's den. That's the punishment for obeying God. And they will be in a lion's den in the tribulation period, that's for sure. So when Daniel now knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God as he had been doing previously. So Daniel doesn't change his routine of life at all. When he knows this document has been signed, when he knows that he can be accused by any one of these other government leaders and officials here of violating Darius's edict, he still goes ahead on. Now, one could say, well, what the heck, Daniel? Just pull your curtains. You don't have to keep doing this in the open. But he chose not to do that. He chose to go right on worshiping God like he had done before. This is a warfare between God and Satan, and I think Daniel kind of understands that. And he's not going to give Satan any kind of a small victory, or whatever you might want to call it. He's going to keep right on praying as he did. These men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. They all had their cell phones out snapping pictures right and left of Daniel on his knees praying to his God. They knew he would do it, or thought he would do it at least. And they came and caught him doing this. Now, we have these principles taught to us in the New Testament, do we not? That we are supposed to be citizens not only of heaven, but citizens of this earth, and we're to give unto Caesar what is Caesar's. We're to obey the government. We're supposed to be good, law-abiding, obedient citizens, are we not? So why didn't Daniel just say, hey, the citizenry, the civil government here in Babylon, it's now Medo-Persia, just said, I can't do something. Why didn't he then not do it? Go ahead, Janet.
When the government condemns what the Bible condones, you go with the Bible.
That's exactly right. Civil government has limits to it, doesn't it? God has invested civil government for the purpose of controlling mankind and things of that sort. But it's always limited authority. Just like in the home, the father is the head of the home, but he has limited authority. In the church, the elders are head of the church, but they have limited authority. So there is authority invested in the civil government, and Daniel could have hid behind that, but it's limited, and there's a conflict here between them, the civil government, and God's laws.
Basically, the civil government decreed idol worship. So.
Yeah, yeah. So Daniel chooses, he's going to obey God if there is the conflict. And that's remember Peter's lessons in Acts chapter 4 and 5. He said, you guys can do what you want to do, but God has told us to preach the name of Christ, and that's what we're going to do. You decide for yourself what's right, but we're going to preach the name of Christ. So it's that same principle at work here, and so Daniel presses right on with that. But they have evidence now of his behavior, of his, in effect, violating the edict that Darius made. So then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Hey, didn't you sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? And King Andrew said, yep, you got that right. His statement is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Well, then they answered and spoke to the king and said, well, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, he's a Jew, Darius. He didn't pay attention to you. And notice these spin doctors have been around forever, haven't they? They don't just present basic facts. They spin it to try to offend Darius as much as they can. They don't say, well, Daniel has chosen, even though he may admire the heck out of you, he's chosen to obey his God. They say, no, he's doing something to make you look like a monkey. And that's going to make him even madder than if they just simply presented the facts. He doesn't pay attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. He knew it had been signed. He does pay attention to it. He's just not going to obey it. He's going to continue to worship his God and make his prayer petitions three times a day. As soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. He realizes he's been caught in his own trap. He's thinking, oh no, he's in violation of one of my decrees and I can't change my own decree now. What am I going to do here? How am I going to get this guy out of this thing? Because he obviously thinks very, very highly of Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. He keeps trying to find a way that he can get Daniel out of this mess. So the men came by agreement, the king, and said, recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which a king establishes may be changed. Recognize, O king, that we got you. We laid a trap for Daniel, and you stepped right into it. So the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. Now, I don't know how much of this he actually believes. If he really believes what he said, this guy has got a fairly healthy recognition of Daniel's God here, and knows that his God can somehow or another deliver him from these, from this lion's den.
Or he really hopes that Daniel's right.
It may be more hope than faith. That's true. We don't know. We can't see the man's heart. But he's got some recognition of Daniel's God. He bring a stone and laid it over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with signet rings of his nobles, so that nothing might be changed in regard to Daniel. Now, as I say, it isn't happening now, but later on, these guys will be, the Jewish peoples will be in a very similar situation to what Daniel is here, in here. He is going to be, they are going to be at odds with all of the other governments on the planet. People will be happy to destroy them given any chance at all. So what are they going to do? Even Darius recognizes that their security and destiny lies with God and his sovereign care of them, not anything having to do with men. Your God, whom you constantly serve, he will himself deliver you. Even this guy recognizes that. So hopefully they will too, especially if they're taught this passage by these 144,000 witnesses that is going to be on the earth. So the trap is set. Darius unintentionally set it off. And Daniel is in this predicament. Just like the Jews are going to be during the tribulation period. They're going to be all by themselves on this planet. Hated by all peoples, the Lord said in Matthew 24. So the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting. No entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. Now, clearly, he has quite an attitude about Daniel, or he wouldn't be doing this. He just went home, got a good night's sleep, and wouldn't have cared. So he loses a good player, okay? He can replace Daniel. But clearly, he is bummed out here. He is greatly upset that Daniel has been, in effect, caught in this snare by these other guys. So then the king arose with the dawn to break a day, and he went in haste to the lion's den. And when he had come near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God been able to constantly, that whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? Now this one is a question, isn't it? Earlier was a statement. Your God, whom you constantly serve, himself will deliver you, verse 16. That was a statement. This is a question. He doesn't know. So he's not clearly a man of great faith in the God of Daniel, but he's holding out some hope at least. So he cries out and says, Daniel, are you there? Have you been delivered by your king? By your God? And Daniel spoke back to him and said, O king, live forever. Obviously, he hasn't been eaten because he's talking to him. And Daniel explains his deliverance in this way, verse 22. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth, and they have not harmed me. Inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. So, yeah, I've been delivered. God has sent his protective angel into this lion's den and shut their mouths, and I'm okay. God can do something during this time period right here to keep these Jews, the faithful ones, alive. Same principle as we in 2 Peter 2:9. God is able to deliver the godly people from temptations and testings while holding the guilty in reserve for punishment. It's that same principle illustrated here in the Old Testament. God sent an angel and shut the lion's mouth. Now these are not a bunch of old, half-dead, toothless lions that ain't hungry and ain't all that interested in Daniel or anything else, as we'll see here in just a minute. These are killers that God has clamped their mouths shut. So the king was very pleased when he heard this, and he gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, so no injury whatever was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. That is the basis for his deliverance, belief and trust. The same thing these guys will have to rely on during the tribulation period. It will be, as I say, a often taught chapter, I suspect, during that time frame. So the king gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel and cast them, their children, and their wives into the lion's den. And they had not even reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. I mean, the lions start attacking these people before they can even hit the bottom of the den. These guys are hungry, big, mean, killer cats that God shut up for Daniel's benefit, but these people unfortunately reaped the benefit of their malicious plot.
Yeah, kind of backfired a little bit.
What's that?
Kind of backfired a little bit.
Yeah, it really did. Kind of blew up in their face big time, didn't it? You know, God has a way of doing it, doesn't he? Well, he can shove stuff down people's throat that are trying to shove things down his children's throat better than anything anybody you could possibly find. He can make something out of nothing and does for the benefit of his faithful children. So, Darius, then he decides he's going to write something. He wrote to all the peoples, nations, men of every language who were living in all the land, "May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel." Now again, he shows a little insight here. He's kind of like Nebuchadnezzar was, wasn't he? Nebuchadnezzar was showing some pretty decent insight and understanding of God and his kingdom and his personality and so on. And this guy is doing the same thing. I'm hopeful that these guys will have the privilege of meeting us someday. Maybe they don't, but I hope so. He's the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. A lot of believers don't even understand that. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions.
Sounds promising as far as being in heaven, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. We can hope.
Yep.
Hey, he's showing a lot better insight and understanding, perhaps a little faith, more than some others, maybe. So Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. A couple leaders mentioned there could possibly be the same one, doesn't matter. But at any rate, all of this worked out well for Daniel and worked out kind of not so well for these anti-Semites or these anti-Danielites, whoever they were, and they got theirs. Yeah. Yeah, and this guy knew it. He knew he'd been trapped. Darius knew. That's why he was in such a fuss trying to find some way to undo that. He knew that his own people had snared him with something. He tried to get out of it and couldn't. These guys they'll need this principle drastically during that 7-year period of time. Remember, you got the 144,000 sealed Jews. Those are all young Jewish men. It looks like they're priests. It looks like they're all beginning their ministry at about age 30, as priests did in Israel. Those 144,000 will be the primary preacher and teacher of God's message during the tribulation period. So you got those guys, hopefully, teaching as many as they can and helping these folks find comfort in the assurances here that God can deliver and protect and help them even in what looks like a terribly dire strait. So Daniel chapter 6, I believe, will hang over that seven-year period of time very heavily, will be a help to them quite a bit during the tribulation period. As I say, they know nothing about the tribulation period now. They're 2,600 years away from it, and they don't understand what it is yet. Even if they end up understanding all of this book, they won't know quite what to make of it. But they wouldn't be around anyway. I mean, the people that will benefit from this will be people living during that time. So the message of comfort and deliverance was written 2,600 years before a lot of people will actually end up using it. Okay, Daniel in the lion's den. A message of comfort and help for the Jews during the tribulation period, I think. Perhaps there's some other function of it, but it will certainly be that, I think. I don't know. It seems to me like it's about time for another good dream. What do you all think? We need another good dream. Here's one in chapter 7. Let's look at this one. Now, this is not in chronological order because it's in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Remember, Belshazzar's dead and gone. He's chapter 5 history. He's handwriting on the wall guy. But earlier on, before he was dismissed, Daniel saw a dream. This one is Daniel's dream. Two from Nebuchadnezzar, now Daniel's dreaming. In his mind and visions as he lay on his bed, and he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. So here is another dream from Daniel himself that we're going to have to try to sum another fit into our storyline here. I wonder how that will be. And here's what he saw. It says, verse 2, in chapter 7, verse 2, Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Four winds of heaven. Are there only four winds on this earth that blow around? By the way, the sea is oftentimes in Scripture used to represent Gentile peoples. The land typically represents Jewish peoples. The sea typically represents Gentile peoples. And so in his dream, he sees these four winds stirring up the great sea, or stirring up what probably will become Gentile peoples. Does the four winds ring any bells?
Well, four corners of the earth.
What's that?
Four corners of the earth?
Yeah, I think
from
so.
Everywhere.
Yeah. In Revelation 7:1, after this I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth. Whatever these four winds are, it looks like they're in action again here in Revelation chapter 7. So, and the angels are holding them back so that no wind could blow on the earth or on the sea or any tree. Now, the four is probably just simply representative of the earth's surface, north, south, east, and west. Clearly, wind patterns are all over the place and there'd be more than four, but it's probably just to represent, in essence, all of the winds blowing on the earth have been held back now. So the influence over Gentile peoples, the Gentile nations, like we're seeing here, has been sort of a timeout, guys, in Revelation chapter 7. Here in Daniel chapter 7, they're being stirred up. Gentile nations are being whipped into a lather in Daniel chapter 7. In Revelation chapter 7, time out is called on what's going on there so that everything stops for a little bit. And that's when we get the sealing of the 144,000 in Revelation. But here, the Gentile nations of the world are being stirred up. The winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, the Gentiles. And four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. How many were coming up?
Four.
Have we seen the number four anywhere in this book yet? How many?
The gold statue.
Yeah. How many segments did that statue have?
Four.
How many beasts are coming up out of Gentile nations. Four. Well, isn't that a coincidence? A statue segmented into four Gentile world empires, and now we're seeing four something or another's come up out of these Gentile nations. Well, I'll be dipped. I'm wondering if the same pattern, the same picture, the same theme is being presented to us a second time here, involving four different Gentile world empires. Here they're called beasts. Verse 4, the first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. And I kept looking till its wings were plucked up and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand up on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. Kind of has a little bit of a ring to it from what we saw before, doesn't it? Remember, Nebuchadnezzar was lifted up as an animal and given a human mind to it and all that sort of stuff. That's kind of ringing a little bit like what we saw before. Is it not? And behold, another comes up, a second one, resembling a bear. By the way, the lion, a winged lion, was the symbol of the Babylonian Empire, by the way. So when Daniel sees that in his dream, that's another clue for the reader. Here, the next one, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one of its sides, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, arise, devour, eat much meat. Now, in the Medo-Persian Empire, the Persians were much stronger than the Medes. So this thing raising up on one side kind of pictures a beast that is much stronger in part than another part is here, isn't it? And it turns out that the Medo-Persians had destroyed Lydia, Egypt, and Babylon. And so these three ribs in its teeth may have been those three nations. So we're seeing a pattern that seems to fit our second segment of the statue in chapter 2, the Medo-Persian Empire. That seems to be maybe a repeat. A chapter 2 redux going on here in chapter 7. And behold, I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard. Leopards are pretty swift, aren't they? Which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Remember the third one we thought was Greece, Alexander the Empire's nation, and it was divided into four parts when Alexander died. This one's got four parts to it, it looks like. What we are seeing here in this chapter is, in essence, the same thing that we saw in chapter 2. It's embellished. Chapter 2 and chapter 7 is the same thing. Chapter 7 just gives us a little more detail, a little more embellishment. We're seeing the same empire here represented by a certain type of critter, and the same thing is going on here, and the same thing is going on here. So it looks like what we're seeing is that from chapter 2, the statue, the four-segmented statue, we're seeing the same basic picture, just embellished a little bit. Would you agree? Is that making sense? So after the third one, he says in verse 7, after this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Wow, all of a sudden now we got this number 10 popping back into our picture. Remember we had it here. The 10 toes, iron and clay mixed together, didn't make a real good unified heterogeneous type thing. We're seeing it here now. Only here the 10 represent horns. There it was toes. Here it's horns. What are horns typically representative of in Scripture?
Strength.
What's that?
Strength.
In some places, yes. In other places, the one I'm thinking of is leaders. The 10 horns or 10 kings or 10 leaders. So this the vision in chapter 7 now is referring to, in this fourth beast, which we believe it's the Roman Empire, 10 horns, 10 leaders as part of that empire. Toes and horns are both related in these visions now. So while I'm looking at this thing and trying to figure this all out, Daniel says, verse 8, I was contemplating these horns, these 10 leaders that are sort of a subset of this fourth empire. Behold, another horn came up, a little one. Now this is new. We didn't see this in chapter 2. We didn't see this 11th horn coming up from among 10 horns associated with this empire. We didn't see that in chapter 2. This is new. We're getting embellishments of chapter 2 in chapter 7. A little horn, an 11th one, pops up and pulled out 3 of the previous horns by roots. Oh, now that's new. This fourth empire has a 10-leader grouping of some kind, and an 11th one rises up amongst these and rips up 3 of them and pulls them out by the horn. He's going to somehow or another dominate and destroy and overpower 3 of those other 10 kings that we've been talking about. Got the picture? Somehow or another, this last empire, which looks like it never really was succumbed or taken over by another empire like these were, somehow or another, there is a 10-nation grouping that will grow up out of there, and an 11th one will rise up and uproot, take over, dominate 3 of those 10. Wonder what in the heck is being described here. Remember, we talked about, Pam, could you hit the light switch there? This thing is a little hard to see without some dark. Remember, the red boundary is the old Roman Empire, the fourth beast in chapter 2 and in chapter 7. Now, chapter 2 said, well, 10 of those are going to somehow or another kind of get amalgamated together into some sort of a unit. Is it economic? Is it military? Is it a combination of both? I don't know. Probably is. And all we know is that it's a loose, not really well-formed group will come from these nations you see inside this red boundary. That's what chapter 2 told us. Now, chapter 7 says, of those 10, whichever ones they are, there will be an 11th one rise up and defeat 3 of those 10. He will take over 3 of the 10 that were already there. So this 10 will now be overran by an 11th one who will take over 3 of them. That's what chapter 7 is telling us. Whatever the basis of this 10-nation federation that will rise up during the tribulation period, somebody will come in and kind of take over 3 of those nations. Now remember, chapter 2 said it's clay and iron mix, it ain't strong. We're going to have some Mickey Mouse countries involved in that 10, and we'll have some that are strong. This guy will probably take over 3 Mickey Mouse countries. There will be 3 of them that probably won't give him much sweat at all, and he will take over those 3. So the 11th horn will become dominant, taking over 3 of the original 10. So now you got what? 7, six in this guy. Kind of get the picture of what's unfolding here in this symbology, in this imagery. And behold, this horn, this 11th one, possessed eyes like the eyes of a man. Clearly, this picture is kind of transitioning from that of a critter to that of a person. This is a human agent that is arising here in this symbology. So, at some point in time, and you won't be here to see it, so I'm telling you about it ahead of time, you'll be gone. Some point in time, there will be a 10-nation federation arise of old Roman Empire countries, and there they are. And one guy will rise up from that group of countries and take over three other ones. He will be the star of the show during that 7-year tribulation period. He is Satan personified. He's Satan's guy. What do we normally call this guy?
Antichrist.
The Antichrist. Yeah, he's got 32 different names in Scripture, but that's the one we normally think of and use most, the Antichrist. So he will rise up amongst these European countries, one of these countries somewhere. He'll take over three others, and he will be the dominant player in all of this. He will not come from the United States. The Western Hemisphere apparently has no role whatsoever in this symbology, us or South America. Everything south of the Rio Grande is a bunch of Marxist junk right now, and we're rapidly becoming that, so I don't think there's a place for us in any of this. This is a European issue. We'll talk a little bit more as we go on what could be the cause of it, but it's just speculation anyway. So, going on with the vision, verse 9, I kept looking until thrones were set up. Thrones are normally a kind of a symbol of judgment, kind of a symbol of God's reign and presence here. Thrones are set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. Who do you think that is? Who's the Ancient of Days? That's God, and it's one of the persons of the Godhead, isn't it? Probably God the Father, but at any rate. And his vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were burning fire. If you can understand Ezekiel chapter 1, explain it to me. Go look at that picture described there and tell me what the heck you're seeing. It's God's portable throne. It's got wheels. He can drive it somewhere, in effect. It's his mobile throne, not the throne room in heaven, but the mobile throne. And this is set up in Daniel's dream. And a river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. This is like one of those volcanoes in Hawaii erupting, and a lava stream flowing out from before him, a river of fire. And thousands upon thousands were attending him. I've never been able to get my mind around how the population of heaven works, practically speaking. How do you even see God from where you're standing if there's 10 billion of us there and you're so far back in the crowd you can't even see him? How's that going to work? I don't know. Somehow or another, it'll work. But here's thousands and thousands attending the Ancient of Days, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. That's us. We're myriads upon myriads. And the court sat, and the books were opened. When you see the term books in Scripture associated with judgment, it always refers to the books of works. Those are the works of human beings recorded in these books. When you see the book, singular, it's the book of life. It's the listing of all whose destiny is heaven. Books are listings of works of human beings which are shown to be inadequate to save a person. So books, when books are opened, people are going to hell. They're going into the lake of fire. When the book is opened, people are going into heaven. So watch for that in your study. It's a pretty clear sign for what's going on most of the time. But in this case, the books were opened, just like in Revelation chapter 20. In other words, it's a scene of judgment. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. Remember that 11th guy that came up amongst the 10 horns? He's speaking boastful words. And I kept looking until the beast was slain and his body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. This last kingdom is destroyed by God and his divine forces, and they are in essence just cast into the lake of fire. So this phase of these Gentile world kingdoms is judged by God and cast into the lake of fire. This gets destroyed by God. The Ancient of Days puts an end to this symbology and burning with fire. Boy, that place, I don't even know how to describe this lake of fire thing. It's bad. Bad, bad, bad. Yeah, Jen?
I have a question. In 1 Corinthians 3, where Paul talks about the believer's work is going to be judged, you know, if it's going to be wood, hay, or stubble. Is that in like a book?
No. The books will be for, I think, the non-elect, the lost.
So this is, they're just...
It's a scene of judgment. It's, in essence, the white throne judgment.
And so this is, and I know this isn't the...
That's right.
...for our salvation.
That's right.
Our works are judged.
That's right. Our works are judged for eternal value, and if there is no eternal value, it's like the big wolf that huffed and puffed and blew them down. They've got no lasting value. If your works are like precious stones and have lasting eternal value, you will be rewarded. So some of our works we will get rewarded for, and some of them we won't.
And it doesn't mention a book, but I heard a teaching one time where they were saying, you know, the book of believers.
Yeah.
But
yeah. And an interesting aspect about that book, too, is that the Lord refers to that book. He says, I will not erase your name out of that book. Which is interesting to me because it implies that everybody's name is in it for starters, and the name gets erased out of the book of life if people die in disbelief.
Well, you know, it does say that it's not God's will that any should perish.
I'm sorry?
It does say it's not God's will that any should perish. You know, it's God's will that none should perish. So that would be, you know, starts out with everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
You're erased.
Plus the lake of fire is prepared for Satan and his angels, not for men.
That's right.
So everybody would have a chance, it appears. That's a kind of a little subtle implication that somehow or another the lost names are taken out of the book. They're erased out if they die in unbelief. I don't know if that's a fact, but it's kind of what's implied by the Lord's comments there. He says, I will not erase your name from the book of life. Go ahead.
But anyway, it says, it's like as if you're going toward heaven, it says, whosoever will enter. And then when you get through, you turn around and it says, chosen before the foundation of the world.
Yeah, yeah. That's as good an analogy as we're going to get. That concept is the pairing of the divine election, the prerogative of divine election, and the free will of man. It takes some analogies to kind of grasp and manipulate that. And that one's about as good as any. I got some others I use, and a guy down at First Baptist uses one that ain't bad either. He uses a pulley. He said, if you're in a hole with a pulley, and you're trying to pull yourself out of that hole, if you grab one side of the pulley, start pulling on it, nothing happens because the other side just goes up. If you grab the other side of the pulley and start pulling on it to try to get out of that hole, nothing happens because the other side just goes up. But if you wrap your hands around both ropes, you can pull yourself out of that hole. You can manage the pairing of those two concepts. I use a set of railroad tracks.
Yeah.
Because they always move together. They never get closer. They never get further. They always move together through Scripture. So either way, it's a concept that takes some kind of analogy to manage, and that one is as good as any, I would think. The fact that the gateway to heaven's got that sign on one side and the other sign on the other side, and that's the way it is. And we'll never be able to grasp it all and manage it all with a finite mind, because it is a plan put together by an infinite mind. So we'll come up short no matter what we do, but at any rate. Well, I tell you what, we're in the middle of a dream here, but we can wake up and for a while and come back to sleep next week.
Anyway. We'll
go back to sleep next week. That's right. We'll go ahead and finish this up next time. But what we're seeing here in chapter 7 is a repeat, a replication of chapter 2 with a little more embellishment. Things in chapter 7 we haven't learned from chapter 2. We know about this 10-nation thingy here, and one of the leaders of the 10-nation thingy rising up and destroying the other three. So we'll add more to that, and then we're going to have another vision later, and we'll get even more information on it. So by the time we're done, by the time we get the whole chart piece together, we'll have a real good picture of what's going on. Questions or comments? Yes?
I'm sure this is a whole other series of lessons, but just a quick answer. Why, during the tribulation, are the Jews hated worldwide?
They're being prepared to receive Messiah, which they rejected the first time he came. And they're going to learn the hard way they have no friend other than God. God is their only source of help, their only friend. And so they're, in essence, cut off from mankind's help in preparation to receive him. And the rest of the world will attack them, hate them, try to destroy them. This guy we're just being introduced here to, this 11th horn, he'll try to destroy them. He'll do all he can to wipe the Jewish people out and any other of God's people that are one to him by faith, by the 144,000 and whoever. He will try to destroy all of them, but God will destroy him. He's a not to worry for us. People that are here will have to live under his evil rule for 7 years, but God will take care of him in the end. Any other questions, comments?
Yeah, so the 144,000, are they preaching Christ?
Are they what?
Are they preaching Christ?
They're preaching the gospel of the kingdom. A little different than what the gospel of that we preach today. The focus will be on the imminence of the Messianic kingdom and the return of Messiah. Where today we focus on the cross and his substitutionary death for us and that sort of thing. So it is the gospel of the kingdom as compared to the gospel of the cross. It will lead men to faith in either case. We'll see a little more about them here, of course. And they're mentioned specifically in Revelation chapter 7. That's where the 144,000 are named. They come 12,000 from each of 12 tribes. You all have a good trip. And we'll see you when you get back. And we'll see you all next week, Lord willing. Yes, ma'am.
That reference in Revelation about the books. What was that, chapter 7?
20, I think, is where the books show up at the White Throne Judgment.
Okay.
I'd have to go look for sure. Look in 20 and see if you can find it. It's right around there, I think. All right, we'll let you all roll. You have a good one, and we'll see you next Sunday or whenever the world travelers get back. Do you get off the boat once in a while?